This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Homes.com knows having the right agent can make or break your home search. That's why they provide home shoppers with an agent directory that gives you a detailed look at each agent's experience, like the number of closed sales in a specific neighborhood, average price range, and more. It lets you easily connect with all the agents in the area you're searching, so you can find the right agent with the right experience and ultimately the right home for you. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of 100 Words or Less, the podcast. I'm your host, Ray Argans. And I'm sitting here on a rainy Monday morning recording this beautiful intro that I know so many of you love because you get to know the comings and goings of my life. Just kidding. I actually recently got a comment on YouTube. And this always, I wouldn't say bothers me, but it irks me, where the person left a comment somewhere along the lines of, "Hey, remember who you're interviewing, dude." And I get it. There are times where I talk about myself, but that's the nature of podcasting. And I think people that leave those sort of comments or throw that criticism my direction are people who are, frankly, not used to this format and not used to the idea of a conversation rather than a stereotypical interview. And usually, most of the hate that I get is really all directed on YouTube just because, you know, I throw these episodes up there and it goes out to the unwashed internet. And those people can dive in and out and be like, "What is this? This isn't even an interview. I want to hear the guest and blah, blah, blah." And it's like, I get it. That's why these people are on the show. But, you know, there are times where I'm bringing my own personal baggage or anecdotes or stories, and it adds to the conversation, hopefully, because then in turn, it will have the interview subject being able to spin off that idea. And anyways, but I digress. Here we are. I haven't even introduced the guest. The guest this week is a very special one for me personally. He's been on my list. Like, you know, you come up with lists of things when you start to do something and you're like, "Oh, I'd like to accomplish these things." He is a person who I've always kind of circled around and been like, "Oh, I randomly hit him up on Twitter, but, you know, I can tell he doesn't use that platform a ton." And I just always wanted him on the show. Then I get hit up by his publicist and I was like, "Oh man, this sounds perfect." So Steve Kleisnith. Kleisnith? Yeah, I'm butchering his name, but Steve Kleisnith, that's what I'm going to go ahead and go with. He is the drummer for Further Seems Forever, as well as Strong Arm, and he also played a stint in Shai Hulud as well. Further Seems Forever is doing some reunion shows recently, playing that record How to Start a Fire from front to back, which I get to see this week. I am incredibly excited about, and I get to meet Steve in person. But the reason that he was so important for me to have on the show is the fact that Strong Arm was a huge band for me. When I first started to get into hardcore and like the heavier side of music, I didn't go in to the heavy music stuff with a slant towards metal. It was definitely more on the, you know, hardcore punk side of things. So, and I still profess to be a Christian. So I have a spiritual connection to the big man upstairs. And Strong Arm was like, holy shit, it was unbelievable. Like the connection that I felt with the band and the fact that they were singing about these things that were, you know, spiritual in nature, but could apply across the board to anybody struggling with anything internal. And the record Advent of a Miracle was so huge for me. Between that band and Focal Point, Suffering in the Masses, both of those records were just like cornerstones to me understanding expression and the way that people could talk about their feelings in a very safe manner. So Steve was great on the show, and I'll get to our interview in a moment, but I'm not at South by Southwest. I know many of you that could be listening to this as we speak on the airplane back from South by Southwest to wherever it is you're going. I don't know if I like the festival. I've been, I think for 2 years I went, and I've been for a couple of years. It's cool. It's fun. And I like to see people who I haven't seen in quite some time, but it's exhausting. And if I don't really have some justification for me to be there from a business perspective, I'm not going to take time away from my family and the fun stuff that I have going on at home. So no South by Southwest for me. And honestly, I'm kind of glad about that. I think for me, once every 5 years is really all I need. Even though there's really exciting things, I'm more drawn to the technology side of things, not even so much the music, but there is some incredible stuff going on in the technology space and with my day job in regards to podcasting, and it's just, there's some exciting stuff. So I'd find myself maybe going down there more so for that than the actual music, which is weird to say, but I think also because ever since, Emos went away, where that was like, you know, the bedrock and cornerstone of like the all ages scene within Austin. Like, of course, there's still a lot of great clubs and there are a lot of great people doing amazing things down there, which I get to be in Austin in early April, which I'm excited about. I feel like once that venue went away, even though, to be clear too, Red 7, booked by a good friend, Ron Martinez, I think he still books there. both of those are just amazing clubs. And once Emos went away, I was kind of like, oh, that's sad. There's no more of that sort of stuff going on. But anyways, I digress. And, like I said, let's dive into Steve. I didn't know how to approach this interview because, he hasn't been in the interview circuit for quite some time, and I wasn't exactly sure how he was going to take these line of questions, but he was so excited and so willing to go to the deepest, darkest corners of his memory and unearth these gems that, I just wasn't aware of, which was awesome. So I was promised myself I wasn't going to say without further ado. Remember that from last week? Yeah. Oh, geez. All right. So here's my conversation with Steve, and I hope you enjoy. Yeah, that feels good. Hopefully I can lock into that and then say that a lot, and then you guys will be like, hey, you say that like every single time you go into an interview. And so, and then I'll have to change it from there. So the struggle, right? The struggle in using words. So here is my discussion with Steve, and I will talk to you after the interview is over. I do that too. For those of you that like immediately shut off the podcast once the farewells are said, stick around for like 10 more seconds. And usually I like to reveal the guest for the upcoming week. So anyways, here's Steve. I definitely, like I was mentioning before, strong arm was this kind of revelatory thing to me because, coming from the sort of, punk and hardcore scene here in Orange County, there was a really, really big push, especially in the, right around when I started to go to shows in like 96, 97. I just noticed this really distinct divide of like, all right, well, here's where the Christian hardcore bands play and here's where all the rest of the hardcore bands play. Like never the two shall meet. And if they do, it could be quite awkward. And it just, to me, it was never like, oh, I don't get that. I get that there are two ideologically different bands, but why can't they share the same bill? Is it strange for you to obviously still have this, obviously, like I was mentioning before, this connection that people still bring up Strong Arm, where it's just like, well, that was something I presume was obviously very passionate at the time, but at the same time, I'm sure, as in most young people's bands, kind of accidental that you guys were doing what you were doing in certain respects.
Right. Well, I wasn't an original member of Strong Arm, so I was the drummer on the second record, The Advent of a Miracle.
Exactly.
In which the drummer on the first album became the singer.
Right.
On the Advent. It's funny you mentioned the division. I don't remember. I mean, I'm not doubting you. Obviously there was. For some bizarre reason, when it came to Strong Arm, we we did shows on the West Coast that were actually with regular groups usually. Like, I remember one in particular, I guess the first thing that shot into my mind after you mentioned that sort of period of time was the Showcase Theater.
Of course.
I think is what it was called. And then I remember us doing a pretty awesome variety kind of hardcore show. It was like us, and then it was Unbroken, and it was Mean Season, and a band called Gehenna, I believe. And so we were actually the only Christian band, or what you would call a Christian band, on that bill when we played in California. And then, you know, obviously, I did some stuff with Shiloh, or did touring with Shiloh as well, and actually Strong Arm and Shiloh. You know, that's interesting. That's an interesting dynamic too, because Strong Arm and Shiloh would tour together.
Right.
So I would be doing a double set every night. So the being completely wiped out by the end of the night. But I mean, that was a correlation of a regular group, I guess, and a Christian group. And the people, if I can recall correctly, that would go to the shows, I mean, we would always seem to coexist and enjoy it just fine. Now, I will say that there, to my recollection, there were certain areas, I just don't remember California being one of them, but obviously we were only there maybe a few times here and there.
Right.
So as far as going that far on a tour, Atlanta was definitely a city. When we played Atlanta, that feature definitely existed where it would either be a division or it would be your secular people coming to the show to heckle us, you know, and stuff like that. And, you know, that some of the, I guess you would call secular hardcore kids would be part of a lot of different groups that were sort of anti-religious or sort of, of that ilk. And they would actually come to our shows and sort of mock us maybe and things of that nature. Like, I remember that happening on a couple of occasions in Atlanta and like some southeastern regions. But I actually don't recall in my own experience having that kind of situation when we did shows out west.
Sure. Yeah. No, definitely. I could see. I'll make the important distinction in regards to that, because, yeah, they're definitely... I guess was no problem with the bands playing together, but there definitely always was, and maybe this was the vocal minority, obviously pre-internet, where you just had your people being like, oh, fuck that band. Like, you know, they're whatever. They're a bunch of Christian hardcore kids. Like, we're not going to go to that
show.
Right. We're not going to watch it or whatever. But then, yeah, when you actually came down to it and played the show, there wasn't any sort of like outward hostility towards anybody, but it was strange, because I did start to notice that vibe where it was like I was, you know, one of the few friends or one of the few people in my peer group that, you know, was really in love with Strong Arm. And it's like you had these people that had this, would listen to Shai Halud but not listen to Strong Arm, just based on the fact they'd be like, oh, it's like going to church. And I was like, I can understand you to a certain extent, but it's like these bands are sonically very, very similar. Like, why can't you listen to both?
I was going to say, well, if you are listening to Shia Lid from a music perspective, you're listening to Strong Arm.
Exactly.
Because, like, Josh Colbert, obviously, was Strong Arm, and then further, and Matthew Fox, who was Shia Lid, I mean, just by virtue of friendship, were very close and wrote together all the time, and their stylings were very... Even though they were very creative and definitely went different directions, there was a similar formula at times as far as the transition and the movement of the music. And so those two guys are some of my favorite people to create music with from a drum perspective, because the way they write, there's just so much transition and movement in it. And I think that's sort of assisted in the uniqueness of our sound from time to time, as opposed to your chugga-chugga or kind of regular stylings of a lot of hardcore during that period of time. But
mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And you, yourself, you were born in Virginia, but then migrated down to Florida. At what age did that happen for you?
I was born in Fredericksburg, Virginia, grew up in Alexandria, Virginia, just south of D.C., and then I moved down to Florida, still with my family, I believe when I was 10 or 11, so I was still relatively young. I moved to Tampa, Florida, lived in the Tampa-St. Pete area for a while. Then was still with my family and actually lived in Texas for a couple of years. Ironically, I lived in Texas in the Dallas area at the same time my bassist Chet Neptune did, but we didn't know each other, of course, or hadn't met yet.
Right.
But we both lived in that Dallas-Fort Worth area for, you know, or in my case, just a couple of years. I think Chet may have lived there longer with his family, living in the same area and not realizing it until we talked about it just randomly through conversation, like years later. I mean, even after knowing each other years later. And then I came back to Tampa, graduated high school in Tampa, Florida, moved to South Florida in 1995 to join Strong Arm. We were already sort of acquaintances or friends. They had come up to play some shows in Tampa, and they had attended, at the time, a church that I was drumming at, and they sort of had viewed me play, and they liked what they saw or heard, and they were like, you know, I guess when they had a situation where they needed a drummer, they had called upon me if I'd be interested. And so I wound up moving down to South Florida, joined Strong Arm. Obviously, we had a period of time where we were touring, or at least trying to tour full time. Mm-hmm. And then from that, Shai Alud followed soon after, who was also local in South Florida, and wound up drumming for them and sort of doing both bands for a little while. And then from there, naturally, it morphed, at least as far as Strong Arm, when it morphed into just wanting to write something different musically, sort of being old of just being pigeonholed into a definitive genre of music. And so we just started writing other stuff that would be more equated in the rock vein. And then eventually befriended through the local music scene with Chris Carabo, who was in a band called the Bacon Andes at the time. Mm-hmm. And then once that was over, we were writing this new music. We always thought he had a good voice and good stage presence and stuff, so we asked him if he wanted to sing with us, and that birthed Further Seems Forever, I would say, probably in 1998, when we were really first sort of starting to write stuff and get it together for what would become that band. Sure. So a little bit of history.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. You moved a lot. What was there a reason behind that? Like, was your family in the military? Because usually that kind of,
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
No, they just were doing, my dad was in real estate, and my mom was attending, a college that happened to be out in Texas.
Okay.
When we moved to Texas. Mm-hmm. They moved down to Tampa. I'm not really sure why I think it's just they wanted to live in Florida.
Right.
From Virginia kind of thing. My dad had worked for the Postal Service, and then he had to wind up quitting that because he got an injury, a pinched nerve or something, and sort of ceased working what he was doing there. And then, we lived in, he used to be in the Air Force, actually, so you would think that would equate to moving around a lot, but that's not actually the reason we were moving around a lot. But up till I graduated from high school, and then pretty much moved soon after that. I moved out, got my own place, was working two jobs, was playing in a band in Tampa that originally was called Friend or Foe, and then later the name was changed to Pulp. And that was actually the first actual release on a record label I did, was with those guys. And it's the name of the record label is Stiff Pole Records.
Okay.
And the name of the 7-inch record is called Regret. You can still get it today. The name of the band is called Pull, P-U-L-L, and it was me and a couple guys, the bassist, who I'm still, it's one of my best friends in the world. We've been friends for over 20 years. We still keep in contact all the time, and that band was interesting, very experimental kind of music. One would classify it maybe as a cross between post-punk and noise kind of thing.
Okay.
And it was on a label that's really more historically known for straight-up punk rock, but what we were doing was something that was completely
left field
from most of the other releases. So it was pretty interesting.
Sure.
So I was with that group. And then, when Strong Arm came calling, it sort of pulled pretty much deteriorated at that point. We weren't doing as much stuff anymore. And so I said, hey, it's a great opportunity. I already know the guys, friends with them. So I moved down to South Florida and joined them. And then that obviously, that later became Further Seems Forever. I also did live in Tennessee for 3 years. I moved down to South Florida in 95. In 2001, it was the one time I was married, actually, and then my wife at the time she was from Tennessee and sort of wanted to move back there. So I went along with it and moved to the Tennessee, lived there between 2001 to 2004, and then unfortunately got a divorce, and basically at that point I was like, all right, well, I mean, the reason I was there was for her. I didn't really know anybody up there. I was sort of on an island. Got to know people, and Tennessee was a beautiful area as far as outdoorsy stuff went. But moved back to South Florida in summer of 2004, and I've been living here since then. So, been back here about 12 years now.
Sure, yeah. That's your home base.
Yep.
Do you have any brothers or sisters?
I have one older sister who lives in St. Pete, Florida. Her name is Dawn, and she's about 4.5 years older than me, but pretty small family. I mean, it's basically immediate. My mom, dad, one sister, Unfortunately, you know, all my aunts, uncles, grandparents have all passed away. Have some distant cousins, don't really keep in contact with too much. Not really on my accord. It just so happens they're just not really good at keeping in touch.
Sure.
But a relatively very small family. My band and my core group of friends is, in essence, my second family. So.
Sure, sure. And so when you started to kind of develop into, you know, more of the independent music stuff and started to develop your identity in context of that, was that kind of in high school, like when you were in Florida, or had you been, you know, privy to that a few years prior via some other connection?
It actually started really young, unbelievably, like even dating back to when I first moved from Virginia. DC was just so rich and obviously influential. What would later be, you know, alternative music, I guess, through the roots of punk rock and indie rock. But I skateboarded, and I remember just having some friends who were listening to music, who introduced me to some music, even dating back to when I was like 10, 11 years old.
Wow.
That was obviously not the norm of anything on the radio or what have you. And so I actually got introduced to some bands who are still to this day influential to me that were DC-centered. At that point, the punk rock scene there. And so, yeah, at a pretty much young age, I was listening to different kinds of music than what your parents would listen to or what you would just come across on the radio.
Right. What stuff?
So yeah, it actually dates back further than that. So
that's awesome. What stuff was, were they putting in your brain at that time?
Well, it's funny you mentioned brain, because that would be the Bad Brains.
Right.
One band in particular who I developed a love for, through my friends who introduced me to it at the time, even as young as I was. There in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the DC scene at that point, obviously Discord Records was prevalent as far as underground stuff went. So, you know, like Minor Threat and Bad Brains and, you know, bands like that.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of was introduced to and thought, you know, and obviously just the whole culture, skateboarding, that kind of thing. I guess you could say sort of pop these kind of groups up.
Yep.
That, you know, the group of people, the peer group I happen to be with, were listening to. And then I also like new wave, like Talking Heads, big Talking Heads fan. And, you know, certain things you would hear on the radio, obviously classic rock. I loved it all. Like, it's funny, going through school, you know, you're 35, so you're probably old enough to remember. Going through school, you know, you'd have a feature going to like high school or junior high where there was different groups of people, and it seemed like the social groups were almost predicated on the music they listened to.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you'd have preps, and then you'd have burnouts, and then you'd have like punk rockers, and, you know, or people in the hip hop or what have you. And it seemed like a lot of times people sort of were pigeonholed into certain groups of people, and they seemed to have a similarity even with the music they listened to. Not so much anymore, but back when we were growing up. But with me, I was even a chameleon back then. I had like a lot of different friends who were sort of, you could sort of visually put them in a certain group of a peer group. And I was just sort of this guy that was floating around. I almost call, like, a nickname would be Casey Jones, like from the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, or
sure.
Just a guy coming out of the wilderness trying to sort of take things from different groups and experience and listen to different kinds of music. So, I was all over the place with music. I mean, everything from Michael Jackson to, you know, to Talking Heads to, you know, what have you, so...
Yeah, well, I it's funny you mentioned that, because I was actually going to make a correlation a little bit later on in regards to, you know, whatever, connecting, obviously, your deep passion for video games and obviously the connection to, you know, punk rock and hardcore, where it's like I like that notion, and I always feel that people are more, I guess, well-rounded when they do bounce between different, you know, groups of people, where it's like, yeah, I am friends with a football player, and they may have introduced me to some things that I might not have been introduced if I just stuck to my, you know, skater or punk friends or whatever. So it's funny that you mentioned that, because I was actually going to peg you as such later. So there you go. I was playing a little armchair psychologist before.
Well, it's funny, because video games were a big part of my life too around that period of time when there was arcade, obviously. And
right.
That was a big social hangout spot for arcades, because, I mean, when you go to an arcade in the 80s, you know, you're meeting new people, you're discovering new games as they come out. It was like a nice, you know, sort of an escape between school and going home, you know, a place to go where you can meet other people your age, actually be doing something, playing a game, and then just hanging out and, you know, meeting new people. So it's definitely, arcades were a big part along with skateboarding or hanging out with kids at that point in time. So
yeah, no, it's cool because like I said, it does give you a more well-rounded view of the world when you are getting these different influences popping into who you are. Really focusing in on your drumming, and obviously the fact that your style of drumming is incredibly unique in the fact that it's very frantic and technical, and definitely never something that I would be like, hey, if you're just learning drums, like, go ahead and watch Steve play, because like I said, you're a very technical drummer. Do you attribute that to anything, like in regards to just kind of what you were initially interested in as far as drums is concerned? Or was that just like a function of the people you were playing with?
Yeah, I think it was, I think part of it it's not forced. It's just naturally what comes out of me sometimes, the way I tend to write. I guess some people would view it as unorthodox. Definitely a part of it is the second option B, like you said, as far as the people that you write with. I mean, especially when it comes to the initial bands that you know me to be a part of. Mm-hmm. Those guys are just tremendous in their creativity and their approach to writing, even guitar and bass. And so it's sort of naturally connected with my mind, the way I approach, you know, writing drum parts or doing drum stuff. But no, I listened to a lot of basic straight ahead stuff, obviously, when I was younger. And, I've been playing drums most of my life. I mean, it dates back to, according to my parents, which I don't even remember, when I was 4 years old. And, my parents tell me the story. Like I said, I don't remember it, but where they took me to a friend's of theirs house and a drum set was set up. And next thing they knew, I just got up and started playing a beat naturally and had never been on a drum set before. So they sort of just like, oh, we know what he's going to do,
right?
You know, to some extent. And, I guess everybody was freaked out by it as far as, you know, my parents and their friends at the time, like, how is he knowing to even play a beat kind of thing? Mm-hmm. And so so my love and my, activity playing drums dates back to that far. But yeah, I would say it's probably more of a product of people I happen to write with, even dating back before Strong Arm and Shilude and further to the early bands I set. Mm-hmm. Those guys were visionaries as well, I felt, musically. It's like they're influenced. I think it's just a product. You're influenced by a lot of different things. And on top of that, what naturally is coming out of you happened to merge into a very unique kind of approach to the framework of songs and the direction and the transition and movement of them.
The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different things that stress us out, right? Like maybe it's something really, really small, like, man, that parking space, it's always taken. And I wish that I would be able to like get it instead of, you know, this person that maybe, you know, is the most courteous and considerate. I know that's something very random, but it's true. We all experience different things throughout the day that trigger us in so many different ways. And there are many times where I have been like, I wish that I had a spot or a repository for me to, you know, get this stuff off of my chest. Because if you bottle it up, that is no bueno. And then all of a sudden you explode on a coworker or a friend or a family member being like, the parking spot. And people are like, what are you talking about? That is where therapy comes in. And I love working with BetterHelp because I'm a huge advocate for therapy, broadly speaking. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, please give BetterHelp a try. It is so easy because it's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you do is fill out a brief questionnaire and then you get matched with a licensed therapist. And if you are not vibing with the therapist for any reason, you can switch it out at no additional charge. Get things off of your chest with BetterHelp. So visit betterhelp.com/Ray today to get 10% off of your first month. That's betterhelp.com/Ray.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates.
Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Right. Yeah. No, it definitely makes sense. Like, yeah, if you start off playing really technical stuff, like that's kind of the direction you're going to go. You're not going to want to, you know, reverse and all of a sudden just be like, oh yeah, I just want to play a simple 2-4 beat. Like that's all. Or 4-4 beat.
Right. Well, there is a time and a place. I mean, if there it fits naturally, then, you know, I'm all for it. But then if something, you know, is written where it's just like, in other words, I feel sometimes like, the term technical or what have you, it's better when it's natural and not like forced just to try to fit something in.
Right.
You know, if it's just naturally comes off that way, then I think that's beautiful. I think that's awesome.
Right. Yeah. You don't want to overly complicate something for just being the fact that like, yo, look how awesome this fill is. I'm just going to blow
it. Like overkill it. Yeah. Or something, or do something where it's taking the onus away from the center of everybody playing at the same time, almost like the center of gravity of the song.
Yep.
You know, like what, you don't want to listen back to a song and it's just like, you know, one aspect or one leg of the ensemble is like sort of overpowering everybody else. Like it sort of has to be a formula or a recipe that it's sort of all, you know, all these moving parts, but somehow there's a formula to it. It's right. You know, it's all sort of working together instead of, you know, one part overshadowing another because of the busyness of it or something.
Sure. It's like you put way too much pepper in that one. Like, yeah, you don't want that.
Right. Right.
From the way that you're speaking about it, in regards to your drum playing and the fact that you obviously moved to join Strong Arm, it sounded like you had some, ambitions to obviously like make music for a living. Even though obviously at that particular time, that wasn't even really a possibility within our world, the punk and hardcore world. Was that just an instinct you just had to follow?
Well, I'll tell you what, at the time, especially with that genre of music, you know, if you're being offered like a record deal from an actual record label who's actually going to make a physical product like a CD, just that in itself was a big deal, you know, back then. You know, if you have a band contacting you, hey, this is our deal. We got signed by a record label. We're going to be touring, you know, for an extended period of time. We're going to have a physical product to sell. There's money potentially to be made. You know, you sort of jump on that if you're used to just playing in bands that just play around town, you know, or that just do local stuff and, you know, don't really ever go anywhere. So at the time when I, you know, first and foremost, I was friends with all of them. So it'd just be awesome to play together with people who you love being around and love sharing life and experiences with. But then on top of that, they had an opportunity, Strong Arm, when they got signed to, at the time, Tooth and Nail, to actually broaden the horizons of what any of us knew at that point. Wow, you mean it's possible to go on a tour? It's almost like a scene in That Thing You Do. Remember the movie, That Thing You Do?
Exactly, of course.
With Tom Hanks as the manager of the band, and, you know, they're just so used to playing, like, talent shows or something, and then all of a sudden, you know, somebody or their music caught somebody's ear, and then they're getting presented this opportunity that's foreign to them where they're like, wow, okay.
Right.
You know, it was sort of that kind of vibe. They presented me this, this is what we're doing. We're going to be busy. We're going to be active. You know, you want to be a part of this. I'm like, of course, definitely a dream is to, in any capacity, to be able to do what you love to do. As far as I'm concerned, is a career as opposed to a job, even though everything feels like a job, you know, sometimes, but because of the work that you have to put in leading up to that 1 hour, hour and a half of glory of just being able to perform for people.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of work that goes into it with traveling and loading in and setting up and keeping track of stuff and all those things, you know, can feel like a job sometimes, but the pure performance, knowing that people are showing up to pay money to listen and view what you've created is something that should never be taken for granted. So no matter how many people there are.
Yep. Oh, you know? Of course. Ten or 100, it's cool.
Yeah. So at the time, yeah, it was one of those things where, wow, these guys, you know, are really in a position. They're doing something and they're active and they're, you know, plus, you know, if you like to travel and I can't think of a better way to see the world, to see the countryside than, you know, at least getting paid something to do it and do what you love to do on top of that. So it was sort of like a all systems go, like a perfect storm of get to hang out with friends, get to play music that we're making and, you know, get a product out there that we can present to people and, you know, and then from there they can present to people and what have you. So yeah, it is definitely more of an opportunity that we were like, wow, let's try to take advantage of this.
Right. Obviously when Advent of a Miracle came out, pardon me asking this question because it seems like so basic, but just like, you know, was the record well received? Because, you know, I felt like I got into it and by that time you guys had already, you know, kind of disbanded or moved on. And so I didn't get a general perspective of how that record sort of impacted it initially. I know obviously where it sits now, but was there a very high level of enthusiasm once you guys started to play out, or was it kind of met just like, okay, well that was a good record, way to go?
Right. I guess it probably, I'm sorry, I'm making noise here.
It's all right.
I guess it would depend on who you talk to or where we went. I mean, there's obviously, you know, certain areas that where we would come across people who are more enthusiastic about it than other areas we would play or what have you. I mean, since we put out Atonement, obviously, and then the second record, I'm trying to remember back, to be honest with you, but yeah, I guess there was a sense of anticipation and a sense of people were ready to see what we were going to offer next kind of thing, at least within that scene of music. So, yeah, I would say that it was well received and, you know, we did a couple tours off of it. Probably didn't tour on it as much as we wanted to.
Right.
Just by typical virtue of, you know, you get five guys in a band, motivation levels will wane, you know, priorities to other stuff takes over and you're just not able to do as much touring or whatever as maybe one person would like to as opposed to another. So, but usually we would tour in the summer, if I remember correctly, regarding that album. And I know we did a tour with Overcome at the time for Advent.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure we did. And then we did a tour with Zayo. And as far as Out Your Way, I remember playing with Focal Point and like bands like that.
Right.
Periodically. And then, so yeah, I would say there was definitely a spirit of anticipation to see what we were going to, how we were going to top or match what people have come to love regarding Atonement. And they really are. I mean, there's aspects as far as the guitar and the melodies and the movement, I guess, that are similarities. But I consider Advent to be definitely somewhat of a different album than Atonement.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's, I mean, you're for a person trying to listen to Strong Arm, it's not like the first listen is going to be Atonement. You're going to present Advent of a Miracle in order to steer them in the right direction.
Gotcha. Okay, well,
yeah, there you go.
Good to know. I didn't know that.
Yeah, there you go. Come on. It's not like you want to be, especially if you're presenting it to a younger person, it's not like you want to be like, oh, dude, check out the Trial 7-inch. It's like, no, you go to the best product, in my opinion. But
okay.
The, gotcha. And so, like, as you, just collecting my thoughts. One last thing in regards to Strong Arm, where the record, like you were mentioning a little bit earlier, I can still listen to this day, and the record is so goddamn loud. Like, it is really, really loud, and, like, obviously that is what can kind of make a record, you know, a little bit more timeless, where it's not like, you know, a lot of the mid-90s and even late-90s hardcore bands, you know, you can listen to whatever, a Chokehold recording, and be like, oh my god, like, it sounds like they're throwing trash cans down a hallway, you know? Whereas this record, it's definitely more polished. I presume that was very intentional from you guys to obviously have a very, I guess, high-quality recording and not just kind of be like, oh, let's record it with our buddy down the street and that sort of stuff.
Right. Oh, well, you know what? For Advent of a Miracle, we actually did record it in a pretty nice studio at the time with, like, a professional board. I remember the engineer, I believe, was a guy named Jeremy Stoska. And I guess the budget, I mean, it wasn't like, I mean, now it would sound like a nothing budget, but I guess back then maybe it's a good enough budget for us to pull off going into a nice place and making a professional style recording of the music so you can actually make out everything. I know what you're saying. I mean, there's actually timeless hardcore records where the recording itself is terrible,
right?
But the songs are great, and you know, it was discernible enough for it to grab you and want to see the band live, you know.
Exactly.
But yeah, with the Advent of a Miracle, it definitely was in a big renowned recording studio that was here in South Florida. I don't even know if it's around anymore, and I'm trying to even remember the name of the studio. But I remember, yeah, it was definitely like, I remember us going in like, oh, wow, this is like for real. It was like a really nice studio. And, you know, ironically, though, I will say there, to this day, you know, if we listen to it, now it got remastered, I think. I think Solid State or Tooth and Nail wound up remastering the Advent maybe a couple of years back.
Yep.
But to where it even sounds better now. But it's funny how you mentioned, you know, it's some of the stuff's hard. There are actually parts that we felt even based on the conditions of being in a nice studio that it's funny you said loud, because there's certain parts where I actually wished in listening back would have been more discernible, or I would have actually been louder. Like a couple different songs where, like, Josh had a really nice sort of high guitar part and it's sort of really, really low in the mix as opposed to everything else going on.
Mm-hmm.
So ironically, we actually thought at least the mixing of it, maybe not the recording, but the mixing of it could have been better. And hence it did get remastered down the road. But right. But yeah, I will say that we had access to a studio that probably most bands in that genre of music at that point in time probably did not have access to make a quality recording.
Right. Yeah, that definitely. And yeah, like you said, that definitely helps a record live on a little bit longer and not just be kind of like forgotten to those, you know, those few years of where it's like, oh, yeah, like you said, the spirit of the song is there and the song is good, but it's almost inaudible.
Right.
It's almost inaudible.
You are now entering the Bad Christian Podcast.
What's up, jerks? My name is Matt Carter, and I'm from the Bad Christian Podcast. Yeah, that's me and Toby. Toby and I are from the band Emery, and then our friend Joey, who is a pastor, believe it or not. And what we do on our podcast is, let's see, well, we shoot the shit, we talk about bullshit, and then the rest of the time I think we're full of shit. So the key word about our podcast is shit. And don't let the name fool you. Well, I guess you could let the name fool you. I don't know what the name really means. But we're the Bad Christian Podcast, and you can check us out. Find us on iTunes and wherever else.
As you started to, obviously, you know, play in Shy Elude and start to become, you know, more active, because there definitely was a lot of heat and attention placed on Shy Elude once you guys started to, you know, release your first stuff, as far as, like, just with the affiliation of Revelation and everything like that. And obviously, Rob Moran bringing you into Crisis Records and stuff like that. Was it exciting for you to kind of feel like you could go from sort of one thing to another, so to speak, where it's like, okay, like, well, Strong Arm is ending and that's that. But I have this other thing that has a lot of excitement too. Like, was it, did you feel like you were onto something, I guess?
Well, it's funny. Shy Elude got brought about because they actually needed a drummer temporarily, because since I was still active with Strong Arm, and Strong Arm was my first priority, it was one of those things where Shy Elude, the original drummer, was a guy named Jason Letterman, who's a great drummer, good friend. He played in the AAA as well, against all authority, for some time. But you know, they were in need of a drummer. And originally I was only supposed to be like a fill-in guy. Like I was only going to play, you know, maybe a couple shows or just fill in until they got someone. And then it just, you know, it just kept evolving to where they just wanted me to be the drummer. And so I was like, well, it was a little bit of a juggling act at the time. Originally, I mean, initially, because obviously my commitments to Strong Arm and what Shiloud wanted to do in the sense of touring weren't on the same page all the time until we actually did tour together, which was then it was a perfect storm. But yeah, no, Shiloud was, I loved, you know, the writing from Matt Fox at the time, or obviously as an original member of that band, pretty much the brain of it. Just as much as Josh, I mean, he just, what these guys were writing was just blowing my mind. I was just like, wow, this is such great quality, like just melodic and transitional. And it just sort of took to me quite naturally, quite easily for me. And then, you know, they would probably say the same thing on my accord, which what I brought to the table just really meshed well with what they were doing and what they were writing with at the time. And so, yeah, Shiloud was one of those things where I was sort of just doing it to help out. And then it just sort of, they just never looked for anybody else for a while. And then Strong Arm started to sort of get a little more not as active on the touring end. And then at that time, it freed up Shiloud when I was still with them. And obviously with Chad Gilbert singing on that lineup, we were able to start doing our own thing and start, you know, spreading our wings and being able to do more touring as a result of Strong Arm being a little more limited in what they were available to do as far as touring goes. So yeah, it was an interesting kind of, you know, eased in and then sort of took over with that band. So I almost like passing the baton.
Yeah, that's
awesome.
And
then continuing on with the Shiloud for a while until about, like I said, until about 98.
Right.
And then at that point is when the Strong Arm guys sort of came back a column with all kinds of new music that was not hardcore or metal or anything. And, you know, at that point, I was at the point as well where I wanted to just start playing different stuff and not just such aggressive stuff all the time.
Right.
And so, and hence, you know, I wound up eventually leaving Shiloud and focusing more on what would become Further Seems Forever. But sure. In saying that, me and Matt Fox are the best of friends. We talk all the time. I still offer ideas to him and he still shows me stuff and ideas he's working on all the time. And it's always great. You know, he's always, you know, such a awesome creator.
Absolutely.
and writer. So, I mean, I almost look forward to it because I know whatever he's going to show me, I'm probably going to like, so.
Oh yeah. He's a crazy individual, but he's such an endearingly amazing individual as well.
Yeah, definitely.
And so, you know, obviously as you were existing in this world and becoming, you know, really active and touring and all that sort of stuff, how did that sit with your parents? Like, were they ever like, oh my gosh, like Steve is going down this path that we'll never be able to get him out of. Like, you know, he's throwing his life away. Like this, he needs to have a plan B. Like, were any of those conversations happening or is any, you know, turmoil or strife within the confines of your home?
Okay. My parents were always supportive of, anything music prowess that I did because my dad originally was a rock and roll singer himself.
He actually
put out a 45.
Okay.
Way back in the day. And my mom was very artistically inclined too, based on, you know, she was from South Bronx, New York, and sort of what you would consider a beatnik when she was a teenager and, you know, very artsy and culture, a lot of culture and arts and music. And so, you know, they've always been supportive of any kind of endeavors musically that I wanted to take on. You know, they got me a drum set relatively young. You know, I would practice within reason, of course, noise-wise, when it was allowed to or what have you. But yeah, I never had any kind of a situation where they were trying to steer me, like, not to do something or, you know, you're going to go nowhere if you do that, like, that kind of thing. Like, they were always like, you know, go for it, do what you love, and I do respect them. Obviously, we'll always respect them for that. I guess one of the maybe rare people, unfortunately, in this day and age where I have two parents who are still together.
Yeah.
So they'll actually be celebrating their 50th wedding anniversary this week.
Oh, that's a piece of work right there. That's amazing.
Yeah, I know it is. It's definitely miraculous. Obviously, you know, everybody goes through rough times. They,
yep.
you know, been through some rough times throughout the course of my life, but they, you know, they always worked at it and made an effort and kept it going, you know, and, you know, I always respect and cherish them for that. And that sort of goes along with the whole spirit of just, you know, do what you love and, you know, do what you can. So,
Right.
Definitely never had an issue where parents were sort of poo-pooing me to sort of, go after, aspirations musically.
Sure. Absolutely. That's incredible. And so then, I mean, I definitely distinctly remember once Further obviously signed a Tooth and Nail, and like that the news of this band existing was exciting, where it's just like, oh yeah, it's like dudes in Strong Arm playing like emo music. Like that is 100% what I remember someone describing to me. Like, oh, that's probably,
I can believe it.
Yeah. That's probably what this record will sound like. And then I remember once the Moon Is Down hit, it was one of those things where there were very records of that time definitely hit in really big ways, because like, I mean, I remember, you know, another band from your area, it's like when Poison the Well released Opposite of December, it was like, you could not talk to a hardcore kid or a punk kid that hadn't heard that record. Everybody was listening to it. And I felt the same way about The Moon Is Down. It's like everybody was listening to it. No matter if you were like, you know, a tough guy, madball loving hardcore person, like you would say, yeah, dude, Moon Is Down is a pretty good record. Did you feel that momentum pretty quickly in regards to just the attention that was paid to you, or did it feel like a more gradual build?
You know, it's funny you mentioned, but we always had a saying that, you know, Further Seems Forever is the band that hardcore kids' girlfriends listen to.
Of course. Totally, dude.
Sorry, just jokingly. But, yeah, I mean, it seemed to, I don't think we realized quite an impact that album had until maybe later down the road, or even up to now, you know, in doing it and just hearing from people periodically of how much the album meant to them or how much of an influence it was. And I know we loved what we wrote at the time, and you know, it was one of those things where, you know, even the whole record itself was sort of finished last minute. Because at the time, Chris was, he was doing Dashboard, but it was like more of a side project. And even some tours we did, he would sort of do sort of a sideshow of just him with an acoustic. And that's what Dashboard was. And, but it was a side gig, whereas Further was the main thing. And then when it got to the point where I guess the guys were sort of questioning how much we were going to tour with what we were writing. And Chris, at that point, his mindset was completely gung-ho, like obviously doing it as much as possible, which I respected him for because I also was under the same mindset. But some of the other guys at the time, you know, already had families and different stuff going on to where they probably couldn't be as committal as maybe me and Chris could be on the touring end. And so I think that sort of naturally sort of led to Chris sort of going with focusing more on doing Dashboard because he was in control of everything. He wrote everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so he could do it whenever he wanted to. And then, you know, as a result, like the Moon Is Down album was actually, if I remember correctly, I don't want to try to think, like the music was recorded. And then I think Chris later did the vocals.
Oh yeah. I definitely remember word coming out where it was just like, cause obviously like there was a large level of confusion within the independent music community of just like, oh, this dude's doing Dashboard, but then he sang on this record. Like, I don't know what that actually means. Cause of course, like again, the internet was still in its infancy, so no one really had the ease of access to information. Right. So, but yeah, I definitely remember hearing that where it was like, oh yeah, like Chris contributed to this record, but like this can't be his full-time thing because he's focusing on Dashboard or whatever.
Right. Well, that was partly because of us, like, because we were like, well, not me per se personally, but I mean, he was doing both, and obviously, you know, the music was serious and it was great and it came out great and we were loving it, but we just were a little bit like teeter-tottering on how much activity we were going to do touring wise going forward at the time. And, you know, Chris was ready to hit the road and get out there and do it. And so, as a result, you know, he took Dashboard at that point as more of his focus. And, but to his credit, of course, as well, he wanted to fulfill all his commitments that we had already started.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, one of the biggest ones being finishing this album, right, which became The Moon Is Down. And so, like for instance, New Desert Life, I mean, that one was literally done in the studio. That song, which we love that song. In fact, the last song on the record is about as organic and spontaneous as you can imagine as far as trying to, you know, write one more song for a record. You know, it wasn't something that we had already been working on and already had written a long time ago, and now we're just executing it in the studio. This is something that everything happened for it in the studio. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe there were some parts of ideas that were already sort of, we were festering on, but it came together as a song in the studio, actually.
Nice. That's a
and
great
then, and then the same with Chris, you know, on the vocal end. It was something where he didn't really, you know, like he had lyrics already in place for some of the songs, but then New Desert Life sort of just, much like music-wise, came to us as a revelation in a way. It sort of came to him as well in the most, like, spontaneous, organic way.
Right.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Hey, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. As a nostalgic voice from your past, I'm here to remind you that amongst the stressful and chaotic existence we live in 2024, you deserve to get away. It's time for a vacation, no matter when you're hearing this. And let me tell you how you'll get there. The 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe. Want to bring the family to the mountains with the Santa Fe's available H-Track all-wheel drive? Well, it's got standard third-row seating and available dual wireless charging pads for the kids who just want to stare at their phone and not talk to you. You know what I mean. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
That's awesome.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, that's awesome. And I definitely remember, too, where it's like when you guys released that split with Recess Theory, it already had kind of, you know, started to obviously pave the way for the excitement that led up to the record, because there was that initial music out there that was really, really strong. And obviously you guys used all three of those songs for the full length, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Two of them.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, two out of three.
Justice Prevails is only on the From the 27th State EP. However, there is in between, I believe, maybe Just Until Sundown and Wearing Thin, there's sort of a little fodder in the middle. It's like sort of a radio broadcast, and ironically, it's like somebody trying to tune in a radio station. That's the effect we wanted to give it with our engineer. And then you can hear Justice Prevails almost like staticky in the background, like just a part of it really quick before the next song actually came in. And so I guess technically it is on in this town, but just an excerpt from it from a radio frequency, you know?
Totally. That's what comedians call a callback, or it's like, obviously it's like, hey, you know, if you guys listen to the first EP we put out, like here's a little fan trivia for you.
Right.
And then obviously, I mean, the only reason I'm not belaboring a lot of the records that you did since is because, you know, a lot of that has been pretty well documented, and a lot of people have asked a lot of different questions about it. So obviously that's what I'm trying to kind of shine a light on these different topics.
Sure.
The And so then, obviously, as you know, Further Seems Forever was always in bouts of activity and inactivity. Was it one of those things where were you ever kind of, I guess, you know, maybe frustrated on the fact that obviously you couldn't, you know, do that from a, all right, like I'm going to tour 9 months out of the year perspective. Or did you find it, I guess, helpful for your own, you know, well-being, the fact that you could kind of duck in and out of touring when it made sense and obviously when everyone was on the same page? Or did you feel at certain points it was kind of limiting?
Yeah, no, I definitely felt limited and frustrated as well, because the problem is when you have five people in the band, getting everybody's motivation level to be as a team to do everything and anything you can to for the sake of, if you actually are trying to make a living doing it, it was definitely frustrating at times. Now, in saying that, it was a double-edged sword. I mean, it was also good at times to not burn out and just sort of take a break and, you know, take care and do other things and then come back to it. Yeah, we always had an interesting situation with that, because like our main guitarist, Josh Colbert, who wrote a lot of the, you know, most of the stuff musically, he never toured really. Just didn't really have, his desire was more writing and being in the studio and not really traveling as much. Mm-hmm. I mean, part of that obviously is having a family and wanting to be there for his family at all times, especially in, you know, the growing up stages of his son, for instance. But give me one second. I'm sorry.
No problem.
I'm just going to shut that off. It was definitely, I mean, I'd say the How to Start a Fire era of Further was definitely when we were the most active. We definitely found ourselves for, I'd say, between the years of 2001 to 2005, probably touring 6-7 months out of the year. But with our band, even from the inception, most everybody was either married or in a relationship. So the way we tried to work it out, as opposed to a lot of bands whose management would dictate that they stay out for a whole year or 2 years or something and just do everything and anything. For us, we usually try to cater to maybe going out for 4 to 6 weeks maximum and then coming home for a month or two and then going back out for 3 weeks and then coming. And we try to tailor it to where, you know, we weren't gone for too long in respect to our families and yet still be active enough to make a living doing it. So it was definitely a balancing act. And I would say the How to Start a Fire years is when we were definitely the most active and, you know, legitimately, you know, doing it for a living for a period of time, you know, having music videos out and airplay here and there, and then being on the road and getting on some high profile tours to support and then headlining runs to grow with. So,
right.
But yeah, no, it definitely was, for me personally, now it depends who you talk to, of course. With me, it was, you know, I was sort of more of the spirit of like Chris, even with the Moon Is Down era, where, you know, I wanted to do everything and anything. I just love to travel and I love to play. But then, of course, you know, through no fault of, I mean, other guys just had more priorities. You know, they had different priorities and
right.
They had different family or things going on in their life that they had to be there for. And, you know, rightfully so in a lot of cases. So I understand it in reflecting back. You know, I think we could have done so much more, you know, in the way of touring, if we would have sort of, you know, put the pedal to the metal for a couple of years there in our height. But, you know, in saying that, we had to find a fill-in guitarist most of the time to fill in for Josh. And then, you know, just, I mean, nobody's fault, of course. It's just that's the way it goes. You know, it's like you're in a group of people where you love playing, but you got other stuff going on in your life that takes priority and you can just, you know, you can only do what you can do. When the schedules align.
Right. Exactly.
And that's pretty much the way Further's been and when it comes to the touring side of the group.
Right, sure. Well, I mean, it makes total sense. Like, people have adult responsibilities, and not everybody can skirt those things off. And I mean, you're correct. Obviously, it's like that era of the band was obviously the most, you know, active and prolific where you guys were out there. And I just think, I mean, to me, one of the most charming things about Further Seems Forever, and I don't mean charming in like a sort of, you know, belittling sense, but it's just the fact that there are very few bands that obviously could have three distinctly different vocalists from completely different walks of life. I mean, when I say walks of life, I mean life experiences. They obviously all are connected within the independent music scene. But the fact that, like, I mean, realistically, I'm not trying to blow smoke up your ass, all the records are really, really good. Like, and that's a really hard thing to do, especially you're changing the identity every single record, as far as the vocalist is concerned. Is it one of those things where you find it almost, I wouldn't even say comical, but just like, wow, like our fans have really stuck beside us, because in all reality, they shouldn't have followed us along all of these changes that we've done.
Right. I think that's the end result, actually, like now.
Right.
Now that there's been some time separated from some of these albums that when they first came out, I think it seems to be, and obviously with unfortunate events like John's passing recently, it sucks that it takes an event like that maybe to have people sort of revisit something that they may not have liked initially. Mm-hmm. And then they revisit it and they're like, wow, this really was good. And at the time, maybe I had other vices toward the band where they personalized the band based on one particular singer, and so they wouldn't give anybody else a chance, kind of thing. So, I mean, I don't, you know, we had a lot of critical acclaim at the time these records came out, and there was always, you know, people, you know, your typical historical, oh, I like the old star, you know, I like, you know, the old singer, you know, didn't really give a chance to embrace, you know, whoever the new guy was. But, I mean, I will say, summarizing to now, yeah, it is sort of interesting how we were, I mean, at least for us, first and foremost, what we feel about the music. Maybe luck is part of it, because, yeah, like you said, it's three definitive different approaches. Not necessarily to the music, but definitely to the vocals.
Right.
And so I think people can, hold on 1 second. All right. Yeah, we'll catch up.
Okay.
Sorry. I was just going out. Like I said, you know, Jason being the second guy, he had a lot of pressure heaped on him to live up to Chris's, you know, to fill Chris's shoes. And then John being the third singer, I mean, to be honest with you, it was really rough. I mean, when Hide Nothing first came out, I mean, I would say we probably, what's the right word I want to say? We received a new legion. I don't know if legion's the right word. I'm getting tongue-tied on words right here.
Sure.
A new quadrant of listeners that maybe were Sensfield fans, or like probably older listeners.
Absolutely.
We acquired. But then we had our younger listeners who were unfortunately, it wasn't always about the music, but it was about, oh, well, Jason and Chris look a certain way and they have tattoos and their stage presence or something like that.
Yep.
They equated the band more to that than the actual pure, you know, music of it. And so when John came along, you know, he was a tall guy, older looking, definitely looked nothing like Jason or Chris did. You know, I think unfortunately and unfairly, people sort of didn't give that record Hide Nothing initially or the band a chance at that point. You know, I always heard like a lot of comments like, oh, they've become like an adult contemporary band or something, where we thought the music is just naturally evolving. A lot of our younger listeners who are used to visually seeing a certain image or vibe of what the singer's like.
Right.
And then they just didn't give John a chance or didn't understand what he was trying to do. And so ironically, and even with Jason too, you know, when How to Start a Fire first came out, he always had those people, oh, you'll never, you know, I'll never like you as much as Chris or whatever. And you know, that kind of thing. And so I think the two guys after Chris definitely went through periods of time where we had a section of our listener base that were not, you know, at least initially not warming up to them or not giving them a chance. But then, you know, it's like I said, maybe at the beginning of our conversation, you know, if you set out the right music that, you know, is, you know, you can listen to it 20 years from now and it won't sound dated. I mean, that's really the goal. And I think, you know, now 10, 12 years later, and unfortunately through a tragic circumstance that happened recently, you know, I can't tell you how many messages I've read through social networks or whatever where people were like almost apologetic. Like, I'm so sorry for not giving you guys a chance when this record first came out. Now, you know, hearing about the passing, I sort of go back and listen to it and wow, this is like a lot better than I remembered it. Or this is like, I actually, you know, maybe it just took a different period of time in their life to gravitate or grab hold to what we were trying to do, you know, at that period of time of the band. So. So
yeah, no, I'm really glad you hit on that topic, because it is a very interesting reflection on how you were on that particular record, bringing in these two desperate worlds that wouldn't necessarily intermix with one another, and it was challenging to a lot of people to kind of, like you said, wrap their heads around it, whether it was your young fans or whether it was people that were coming in from the Reason to Believe in Sensefield days and are just like, hey, who's this random band that John is singing for? Like, what the hell is this? It's a very important point. I mean, and you guys, did your best to cope with that, but yeah, it was a hard road to hoe, I'm sure.
Well, keep in mind, even the circumstances of, Hide Nothing, where the music had already been written, Jason left sort of abruptly at the time, which has all been reconciled, and obviously we're doing what we're doing now, or about to. And John came in literally with music that was already written for somebody else. And it's like only one song had any lyrics to it, which is a song that never really got released on anything huge, as far as an actual album. I think it's on some compilation or EP or something, maybe, that the Tooth and Nail put out later to get attention to Jason's version of it. The song is Bleed on a Hide Nothing that John just wrote from scratch, not even listening to what Jason did. Mm-hmm. So the Hide Nothing record, even more oddly enough, I mean, John's in California, and he flies out, he lives with our engineer, James Wisner, for a month, literally under deadline at the time contractually, and, for a tour we had coming up, and, we had to get this album finished. And John came in and as you hear, did probably about as unbelievable a job as anybody could have done under the circumstances of having to learn the music and having to create the lyrics and the vocal harmonies for it in such a short period of time. So even the circumstances of Hide Nothing are very odd and very rare of, how the record was finished.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
And the last thing I want to hit on was something obviously we alluded to earlier in regards to video gaming and how important of a role it played in your life. And obviously, I don't think I could have smiled any wider once the press started to hit, 2 years ago, when obviously you shattered, I'll say shattered, but you now hold the world record for forgive me, I'm totally blanking on the video game, but
Mario Brothers.
So for some reason I was gonna say Donkey Kong, but clearly that's not right.
But you'd be close.
I'd be close.
It's definitely in the same family.
Well, of course. But I just love it, because I think almost every single byline of whatever press was coming out around that was just like, here's this rocker that now holds the record. I found it so funny, because everyone obviously was painting you with this brush that was very probably not the most accurate, where it's just like, it sounded like you're playing for some 80s hair metal band or something like that.
Right.
But I know there's a lot to unwrap here, but just like the notion of obviously a lot of people, even still to this day, look at video games as like, oh, it's a cute thing that people do. And, losers do, as they get obviously older and adult-like, and they just, are shut-ins and don't ever interact with the outside world. What makes it obviously so special to you to be able to, just dedicate the time and focus to that sort of stuff, in regards to obviously pursuing a world record? Cause that's not easy to play Mario Brothers for 6 hours.
Right. Well, I had a love of games when I was younger, obviously, and then went away from it, obviously, when school and work and, life, is happening, and music, obviously, with paying more focus to that. But really, it came down to a documentary that came out in 2007 called The King of Kong.
Yep.
And it was about a guy who I'm now good friends with that lives down here in South Florida. His name is Billy Mitchell, and he was the Donkey Kong world record holder for years. And the premise of the film is basically him and a guy from the Pacific Northwest that are, sort of jockeying for the world record in that classic arcade title. But it was directed by a guy named Seth Gordon, who a lot of people know in movie and entertainment circles. He also directed the first Horrible Bosses movie that came after that, actually. And this documentary came out and just sort of caught fire. I don't know, it was a very popular film, and it was... I'm saying this to somebody, you've probably never seen it, but I mean, in essence, it was it created this sort of retro kind of uprising of people who are my age, men and women, who wanted to rediscover these classic 80s arcade titles and compete for world records on them based on what they saw in the documentary, because the documentary has done so well. And so my band members, ironically, are the ones that introduced me to the film to watch it. And they're like, oh, Steve, this is so you. Like, we know you used to be pretty intense playing video games and stuff. And so, you know, I watched the documentary and it really inspired me. I was just like, you know what? I remember there's a couple games that I remember being really good at. Let me check what the records are with Guinness and Twin Galaxies, which is the arcade division of Guinness. And let me try to sort of emulate what this film was portraying with these two guys that were going for the record to Donkey Kong. And sure enough, you know, Mario Brothers, original Mario Brothers, which would be the stand-up classic arcade cabinet before the very popular Super Mario Brothers that would be on the Nintendo home systems after that. So it was original Mario Brothers, which is the first time that you see the Luigi and the turtles and the crabs and the pipes. And then there was Miss Pac-Man, which I'm actually number three in the world in Miss Pac-Man currently. But so I knew I was good at these games growing up, and I sort of rediscovered them. Much like I said, when that documentary came out and I watched it, and it really sort of stirred me, as apparently like it did a lot of other people. And it made an impression. And, you know, much like, you know, everything comes back full circle, music, fashion, you know, clothes, you know, in a retro way sooner or later. And that's really what has happened since that documentary came out, even to now, with movies like Pixels that came out a little while ago. And so it's just, it is a love. I love games. I mean, I love the classics. I steer more toward the classic games than the newer third-person shooting and home system type stuff. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it sort of stirred in me a passion to sort of revisit some of these games and see how I would fare on them. And there's actually sort of an arcade community, not unlike the music community, where there's people that connect all over the country and the world through different sites, through Twitch channels. I don't know if you've ever heard of Twitch, but
yep, absolutely.
I have a Twitch page. It's twitch.tv/MaximumSteve. And when I stream, you know, you can watch me from anywhere, like stream some of the classic games, and people watch me for tips or to get better at that particular game from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this whole arcade community I discovered that I didn't realize was so, you know, there were so many people that were involved with it around the country. And so, yeah, I achieved the world record literally January of last year, 2015. And ever since then, it's been awesome. I mean, I attend like three or four different arcade and pinball expos throughout the year, and, you know, get my expenses paid for usually. So it's like a nice glorified hobby, and I get to compete, and they actually made a trading card of me.
Nice.
As geeky as that sounds. And so, you know, I sign cards and stuff, and it's sort of another kind of platform besides music to be honest with you, be able to travel, to be able to meet new people, and to be able to interact with people that maybe I haven't seen in a while.
Sure.
Well, so, yeah, I understand, like, and even if you read some of the stories that came out at certain online entertainment or video game magazines or what have you, you'll always see the comments after the story like, oh, this guy must live in his parents' basement, like you were saying, and be an absolute loser. But no, it's more of a hobby. And I have a friend actually who owns a business called Arcade Game Sale right here in Fort Lauderdale. And it's like a repair shop. He buys, sells, trades pinball machines, classic arcade cabinets. He builds cabinets. And actually, I do a side event with him now. During the fall and winter months, like once a month, we convert the shop into an 80s-style arcade. There's usually always 60 to 70 machines in there. And we charge a flat-rate admission at the door, like for adults and kids. And then we put all the games on free play, and it's all you can play all night. It's become a very popular community event down here in the Fort Lauderdale area that I'm happy to promote, advertise, and host. And so it's literally gotten to that point where I'm definitely actively involved when time allows away from actual work,
right,
to be involved with this this arcade community of people who are also awesome people and just really sweet, nice, great, much like, you know, I meet when I'm on tour or through the music scene. It's sort of like an alternate kind of vehicle to get out there and be active and do stuff that you love. So
Yeah, no, it's super rad. I mean, I love that notion of, like we were talking about earlier, just the ability to influence different communities, because obviously you can take all of the same principles that you learned from, whatever the DC hardcore scene and all the DIY stuff that you learned in all the bands that you played in, and obviously apply that same exact hustle to, video gaming. And just that idea that it's like, sometimes people learn about it, that whole DIY culture, in different ways, but for you to be able to live in two worlds, it's like, it's a much more readily accessible thing, for the fact that you can start something in South Florida and just be like, yo, how about you show up here? There's some cool video games. And everyone's like, cool, how do I do that? And it's like, well, you just do it. Like, you just get some friends together.
Exactly. You know what's funny, though? The two communities, like, people I know from both mediums, I guess you could say, mm-hmm. know nothing about the other thing I do, or are not even as familiar with the other thing I do. Like, some of my friends who I just have developed friendships with through the arcade stuff,
right.
Like, they have no idea that I play music, or they barely, they know about it maybe, but they don't understand to what degree or level that, I actually go out with a band and tour or whatever. And then same thing with the music community. It's like, they think that they hear the arcade stuff and they just think, that's just like a funny anecdote. Or that's
yeah.
Just sort of a funny kind of side thing to know about somebody, but they don't realize the level of activity that I do. So it's sort of funny. I find it, amusing. It's pretty cool.
No, totally. So yeah, you can live these two secret lives and people are just like, oh, that's that cute thing that Steve does on the side. You're just like, well, it's pretty important.
Right.
Yeah, no, that's really cool.
Hilarious.
Well, dude, thank you so much, Steve. I honestly really appreciate this. This has been fun for me to get really granular with you and pick your brain about a lot of this stuff. So thank you. I really appreciate it.
No, awesome, man. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, fun indeed, right? Steve, video games. I just love that he is so good at video games. It just makes me happy because I played a crap load of video games when I was a little kid. And I would say that I still play video games, but it's a very limited capacity. It's usually with my 5-year-old son, who is more or less just watches me play the video games he wants to see played. But I just love the dedication to the craft and the love of nostalgia of just being able to spend hours playing these games. I still, every time I see a Ms. Pac-Man game in some gas station or somewhere else, I always have to sit down and play, even if it's like, oh man, I only have like 10 minutes to do that. Well, no, I'll do this. I definitely distinctly remember one time on tour just absolutely punishing the guys in my band when we were stopped at some random gas station in the middle of nowhere, and there was a Ms. Pac-Man machine, and I was on a roll. I probably played for 40 or so minutes, and I'm fairly certain I was either first or second as far as the high score was concerned on that particular machine. And it was it got to the point where it's like the guys were like, dude, seriously, die. We need to go. But anyways, thank you very much, Steve, and thank you very much, Dana, his publicist, for hooking this up. I appreciate that. And yes, business stuff. Use the Amazon affiliate code, the link. You can find that in the show notes. Just click on that link, save it to your desktop, save it to your phone, shop through Amazon using that link, and I get a kickback. It's like 4% of whatever it is you're buying. Your prices stay the same. Nothing is different besides the fact that the show gets a kickback, which is awesome. So do that, and you don't have to donate money, which, to be honest, you don't have to donate money because this thing is continuing on from ad support, and I appreciate that. But I did recently get a $1 donation, and I really appreciate that. That's sort of like a tip. Like, the internet says, like, hey, what's up, man? Here's a $1. Hey, thanks. I appreciate that. So, yes, there's that. Visit the website, 100wordspodcast.com. And there's also a show archive up there. I recently was able to work with the podcast hosting company that I work with. And they had this nice little feature where I'm able to feature all of the shows in one convenient player. So do that, because there's, 197 of these things up now. So go ahead and do that. And until next week, please be safe, everybody. Oh, wait. Just kidding. I told you I was going to tease who's coming up next week. And that's not even a tease, because I'm just going to tell you. It's Bo Thompson. He does a thing called Das Bootleg. And technically, this is kind of the first thing he's done from an interview perspective on his company. It's a little risky, because there are some chances that he could get that side of his business taken away, because it is a, the name of the company definitely travels within that circuit. So Das Bootleg. So you can kind of figure out what that means. But anyways, Bo is on the show next week, and it was a really, really good discussion with an old friend. So please, like I said, be safe, everybody.
You've been listening to the Jabberjaw Podcast Network, jabberjawmedia.com. Shh.
The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Trust me in saying that no matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all of the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
I'm so excited to tell you JCPenney and country music singer-songwriter Walker Hayes are partnering together on a new limited-time men's collection for the everyday guy. What I love about Walker Hayes is his laid-back nature. He's a family man, and being a country megastar while also having 7 kids, you know he likes to keep his style cool and casual. This new collection is perfect for the guy living the t-shirt life or someone wanting some fresh options that feel just as good. It's easy to wear, affordable styles that celebrate the ultimate family man, along with the quality, durability, and sensibility dads appreciate. Available online Saturday, May 4th at jcp.com and in-store Thursday, May 16th. Just in time for Father's Day. Limited time only. JCPenney, make it count.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.